you so much. Good evening, everyone. I'm Geneva. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 2nd, 1997. That's a complete coincidence, being the good alcoholic I am. I've never kept a New Year's resolution or any resolution in my entire life. My home group is the Keep It Green group. We meet every Tuesday and Friday at 7:30 p.m. in the Ruckersville Elementary School Library. It's not that far away, so please come any old time. And on Friday nights, we usually go out to dinner afterwards, so come on down. I do have a sponsor who's sitting right over there, and she has a sponsor, and I have actually a very long and rich sponsorship family, and I myself am a big beneficiary and believer in sponsorship. I guess my job is to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Well, what happened is I wish I could say that I had a totally ordinary childhood and just grew up to be an alcoholic. And I think I would have been an alcoholic regardless of how my childhood was. I believe we're born with this thing. But like many people in these rooms, I had a less than ideal childhood. My father was much older than my mother. And to give you an idea about that, she was 19 when I was born and he was 42. He was very controlling and he liked to drink a lot. And He was very, for lack of a better term, he was very abusive to my mother, and I got to witness that on a regular basis. And I didn't put the connection together until a long time later, but I remember as a little girl it would be just me and my mom, and everything would be going well, and we'd have this totally ordinary day, and I remember if my father got home before the sun went down, everything would be fine. We'd have an ordinary dinner. Everything would be totally normal, and we'd all go to bed, and everything would be fine. But if he came home after the sun went down, I'd start getting this ice in my stomach, and I'd start getting nervous. And after my mother put me to bed, inevitably I'd be awakened by screaming and yelling. And it's because he had been out drinking and doing what we do, and he'd come home and act crazy. And as a result, my teachers would complain. I think this is funny now. My teachers would complain to my parents that I was not really doing well in school, that I wasn't paying attention, that I seemed tired. I mean, why, you know? I think it's funny that my parents never said, well, gee, maybe it's us yelling and screaming. Maybe that's why. They just kept having these talks with me about how I need to try harder in school, you know? Denial is powerful. So anyway, when I was 10 years old, my little brother, who's 10 years younger than me, was born. And 6 months after he was born, my father died of a heart attack. And all of a sudden, my mom had to take on raising these two kids by herself, and my father had never allowed her to work outside of the home. He didn't think that she should do that. Also, he didn't give her any money, so she had to take in children to babysit so she could have money to get us things that we needed. So he wanted all of his money, but he didn't want her to work, and yet he didn't want her to have any. So this happened, and all of a sudden she had to go to work, and I ended up having to take on a lot of responsibility at a really early age and help her take care of my brother. And, when I was 10, I wasn't a little girl anymore, pretty much is how I felt. And what that did for me is that that's when I really remember starting to feel like I didn't belong. Like I felt like that I had gone through something that none of these other kids had gone through, you know. I always felt like I was on the outside looking in, like I didn't fit anywhere. And the other thing that it did for me was it gave me what my teachers later termed as emotional problems. Like I started acting out in school. I would throw desks. I would hit teachers. I would beat up other kids. I would have these tantrums. I was just completely out of control. And what I understand now is that, you know, I went from having this, like, experience with this alcoholic, you know, in our home that totally wreaked havoc all the time to having him suddenly die and experiencing this grief that a child really should probably not have to experience even under the best of circumstances. And I was trying to process all that in my already warped little mind, you know. It just wasn't going very well. So luckily, somebody at my school had enough sense to recommend therapy. And there it began. I began having lots of talented therapists for many, many, many years. And this is a journey that would continue well into my 30s. And so there you have it. So I became the crazy kid. I was the one everybody whispered about because somehow wind got out. Like, I'm thinking the only way the other kids could have found out is, you know, the teachers had to have been talking. And, like, somebody overheard that I was seeing a, you know, therapist. Because I wasn't going to school and telling my buddies I was playing with on the playground. Yeah, I guess we talked about therapy yesterday, you know. So that's the only thing I consider, because word got out. And then, you know, I really didn't fit in. And I was made fun of. And I was picked on throughout my entire school career. And when I was about 13 years old, my three cousins moved in with us because their parents, they were on my mother's side, their parents were such advanced alcoholics that they had all three of their children taken away from them. And they were put permanently into the foster care system. And my mother was the nearest relative that was stable enough to take them in, so she did. And the two oldest were two boys, and then my little cousin, who's a girl. Well, the two boys and I, we were close enough in age that we could hang out and relate, and they liked me, you know. They didn't, for whatever reason, they didn't think I was a big weirdo, and they didn't make fun of me. And they liked to, you know, do a little bit of this substance and that substance, and they liked to drink. And because I was their friend, they thought it'd be a great idea if they shared those things with me. And they did. And the first time that I ever drank, I was chasing Jim Beam with Black Label beer, which I didn't understand. I was naive. I didn't know that was a bad idea. But they were doing it, and their friends that were even older than me were doing it. So I was like, yeah, you know, I'm going to do it too. And I was so sick that I blacked out. And I came to, and my oldest boy cousin was holding my head up off the ground so I could throw up. And his friend, who was this big guy, and I'm not kidding, his name was Tank. If he had a real name, I don't know what it was, but Tank carried me home and put me in bed with, like, my, you know, it was winter, so I had on, like, snow boots and a coat and everything. He literally put me into bed with, like, the layers of clothes and the coat zipped up to here and boots, like, in bed. I woke up the next morning like that. So at least he was a gentleman, you know. But I drank so much, I was so sick, I was hungover for 2 days after that, I'm not exaggerating, and I couldn't wait to do it again. I was like, heck yeah, that was awesome. But Ted, you know what happened for me that night? What happened for me finally was I felt like I found my place in the world, you know? All that stuff about me being that kid that had all those problems and that crazy stuff and, like, my dad dying and that sadness and all, that went away, and these people, like, were talking to me, you know. Before I was, like, being, you know, having my head held up off the ground puking, I remember people talking to me, you know. I remember them actually listening to what I had to say. God only knows what I was saying, right? I was probably talking about cartoons or something. But so anyway, they lived with us, and I hung out with them, and I started, you know, doing a little this and that before school. I started going to school, and, you know, it's real hard to concentrate on your studies when you're stoned, so I failed eighth grade, and then I kind of had this little thought, well, maybe I shouldn't do it before school, maybe I should only do it after school. So then and that's what I did, and I would tell them, no, I'm not going to do that before school, I'll do it after school, and I managed to pass the eighth grade the second time around, not with flying colors by any stretch of the imagination, and really, they probably passed me because they were just tired of me, but I passed, and at that point, you know, this thing hanging over my head of the other kids making fun of me and stuff hadn't gone away, and there were and for some reason, they made up rumors about me, which I still find interesting. Because I didn't really talk to anybody, you know. I mean, I had some friends, but they definitely weren't, you know, the cheerleaders or the jocks or, you know, even the drama club people. So I decided, you know what, all y'all think I'm a weirdo, or I'm going to be a weirdo. So I got a weird haircut, and it was the 80s, by the way. I started wearing weird clothes and listening to weird music, and then I made some friends that were even weirder than the ones that I already had, and what I ended up doing was at the age of 17, I decided that I needed to have my own apartment, and I needed to drop out of school and work, because really I couldn't handle school. Really what it was my party schedule was getting in the way of my school schedule. It's really hard to juggle being that drunk and high and doing homework and paying attention to what your teachers are saying to you. You know, just saying, it's really difficult. So, and I decided, you know, being the good alcoholic I am, I chose the path of the party. So I said, you know what? And my mom was driving me crazy anyway. She was up in my business all the time, because all of a sudden I'm not staying home and helping her out the way I used to. I'm gone all the time. I'm coming in late. I smell awful, you know, because I've got booze coming off of me and God only knows what. And Lord forbid, I took an interest in boys, you know, so it's just all going to pot. So I decided, you know what, it would be best for her and me if I moved out. So I hooked up with these two crazy friends that I had, and we got our own apartment, and it was on 24 hours a day. I got a job within walking distance from where I lived, even though I had a car. Yeah, I'm sure you can put two and two together there, right? And, you know, all of a sudden, it was like I became very popular because I was a young person with their own apartment, you know. And during this time, I met three people that I didn't know at the time, but they really had an impact on my life, and they're definitely an important part of my story. During this time, I made friends with these three people, Amy, Marie, and Tom. And, you know, the four of us hung out together all the time, or at least in pairs or in threes. We were always together. We were always hanging out, and they had a key to my apartment. You know, sometimes I'd come home, and one or two of them would be hanging out there, and they were okay. They didn't want anything from me except to be my friend. Now, some of the other characters I had over, I shouldn't have had them in my house, really, because things would come up missing. You know, things wouldn't get returned. You know, one time I came home and there was something that I won't mention going on in my bathroom. And to this day, I don't know who those people were, you know, or how they got my house. I don't know if maybe they were left over from the night before. And like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know. But stuff like that just happened in my life. My point is, that's how it was. It was chaos all the time. I had abusive boyfriend number one move in to my house during this time, and the interesting thing about him is that he was actually in AA when I first met him. His brother was going out with this girl that became my roommate, because see, my first roommates, by the way, I drove them so crazy, they moved out because I was too much for them, and they partied, you know, too. But I don't know if they, you know, converted to Christianity or something, but all of a sudden they were like, you've got all these strange men in and out of here, all these strange people, our food's getting eaten, we can't take it anymore. And so they decided to get another apartment. I was shocked. I couldn't believe it, you know. I thought we were friends. So this new roommate that I had started going out with this guy and hooked me up with her brother. And he was actually in AA by court order because he had done something really awful and had to go to treatment and that whole 9 yards. And, you know, I heard a speaker say, what does an alcoholic bring to a first date? A moving truck? Well, I think that's what he did, you know. And because I was like all blah, 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 you know, when we hooked up, I was like, okay, great, move in. And what I didn't understand about the people in these rooms is that you people have no business being with somebody that was the way I was at that time in my life. You know, I kept vodka in my freezer so it would be cold all the time, you know. My friend and I were going to this bar downtown, not because it was close, but because we knew we could get served there, you know, because they didn't card us and that kind of stuff. That's how I was, you know. But he moved in with me, and 2 weeks after he lived there, he was drinking rum, you know, and then he became really interesting. And some really interesting things started to happen. The cops started to be called by the neighbors. I had Marie tell me at that time, if you don't break up with him, I'm not going to ever speak to you again. He totally screamed and yelled at my friend Tom, who was very dear to me, who never yelled at anybody in his entire life. And I threatened to beat him up. And while he and I are going at it, I turned around and Tom had left, you know. I mean, that guy kind of thing. It was crazy. And that ended because, you know, he split my lip open and you know, the cops had to get called and blah, 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 to get a restraining order. And then he stalked me for a year, you know, that kind of thing. And then I got evicted from that apartment, not because they kicked, wait, this is the great part, not because I was too loud. Can you believe that? That's not why I got kicked out. I'm still surprised about that. I got kicked out because I fell behind in my rent. Okay? Like, because I couldn't, it got to a point where I couldn't get up and go to work enough to keep my job, you know. So that's why I got kicked out, not because I was too loud. I still think that's amazing. And the landlord lived on premises of this apartment complex, you know. So anyway, then, you know, I went through this very long period where I couldn't hold on to a job and I couldn't hold on to an apartment, you know. And I remember I was staying at Marie's house and with her and her mother and her brother. And that was actually one of the few times in my youthing career when things were almost a little bit stable because, you know, I'm really close to her mom, you know, and I was like, and not that there's anything wrong with my mom and my brother, but I think when we're alcoholics and we're in our, you know, whatever, for some reason our friends are more important than our family, you know, and that's definitely where I was, and Marie was very important to me. So anyway, living in that house, you know, seeing how they lived day to day, and it was always calm. There wasn't drama. The cops weren't getting called, and, you know, there was food in the fridge. It wasn't a choice between somebody, you know, buying booze or buying food, which is always my choice, you know. Being in that environment, I almost got stable for a minute, and I got a job. And I started to get some money, and then, you know, I wouldn't go to work, and I wouldn't have any money, and da-da-da-da-da. It got to the point where Marie said to me one day, when are you going to find an apartment? You know, you've been here for a couple months, and, you know, you're kind of doing the same thing you always do. See, but by the way, I didn't mention, she's not one of us, okay? She isn't. She never has been. So I, instead of looking for an apartment and saving money, I got abusive ex-boyfriend number two. Because he already had a place to live, okay? And I hooked up with him, I moved into his place, and boy, did that get really interesting, you know, because it's getting worse, it's not getting better, right, because it doesn't get better, it just gets worse, it gets different, you know, that's the thing, is I can change things around all I want, and it just gets different, you know, and this was different, he was different, you know, but he was also really crazy. He was an unmedicated manic depressive that liked to drink and do drugs, you know. Perfect guy. So I moved in with him, and it got so bad that I left. And at this point, my friend Marie has her own apartment, and I go and move in there for a while because I literally had to leave him because of, you know, an incident where I was thrown against a wall and some stuff like that. And I had to leave for the sake of my safety. And then he broke into her place and, like, you know, did some more of the same thing, like throwing me around and stuff. And I wish I could say that was it, that I broke up with him, but it wasn't, because then he apologized and I decided that he was really different. So I went and moved back in with him again. And I did that, and then, you know, he didn't hit me or, like, physically hurt me, but I can't remember what he said, but he said something, and I realized that he was really dangerous. Like, I can't remember what it was. He said this really crazy thing, and I was like, he's really crazy, and he's really going to hurt me. I've really got to leave. So I left, and that time I left for good. And, you know, got some jobs, got some more apartments, you know, blah, 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 continue to drink and continue to do drugs. And during this time, my three closest friends are starting to move on with their lives, you know. And things are changing, and some other people are growing up, and some other people are even moving away. And it's kind of like, what the heck am I going to do with my life? So my future ex-husband came into my life at this point. I had known him back in the day when I had my own apartment and we partied together. But, you know, then he left town. He lived out of town for a while, and then he came back. And he came into my life around the time the abusive ex-boyfriend number two was on his, like, was going out of it, you know. And he was not physically abusive ever. He never was. And so we partied together and did our thing together, and I made some friends. And then, you know, the first thing that happened was Amy, my friend Amy, got pregnant, and she stopped doing a lot of the stuff that we did together. You know, she wasn't around that much anymore. She had a new responsibility. And then my friend Tom, he moved to New Orleans, you know. And Marie went away to college, and I was like, I need to do something. I need to get a life and grow up. And so I decided to go to college. And I decided to go to college in Atlanta, and that's what I did. And I actually did really well in school. And the only way I was able to do that was by not drinking and not doing drugs when classes were going on. Believe it or not, a college person that doesn't party all the time, I know it's hard to comprehend, but I knew that was the only way I was going to do it. And I was actually an AB student. I did really well. So during this time, you know, I did that. I did college. I did well. I graduated. I got out, and I got a job that I really liked in my field. And that was going really well. And I'm still in touch with Marie, actually. Coincidentally, we ended up both moving to Atlanta to go to college. And it wasn't a conscious decision on her part or my part for both of us to end up there. It just worked out that way. But it was really good. It was really good to have her with me in a big city like that, you know. You know, Amy was here. She was raising her son, you know. And our friend Tom had moved to New Orleans, and he decided while he was there, it would be a good idea to see what crystal meth was like. So that's what he started doing. And through, I don't know really what happened, if it was through him doing that, or what was involved, but he ended up being murdered. And I really didn't handle that very well at all. It was really hard. And it's still hard sometimes, but I'm sorry. But whenever, you know, when I heard about that, I couldn't comprehend it, because it was just like 3 weeks before his 23rd birthday, for one thing. And for another thing, he was a really good person. You know, we did party together, and I know for a fact now that I'm in here, I have no shadow of a doubt that he belonged in these rooms too. But he never was violent. He didn't hurt anybody. He wasn't even a thief. You know, even I was a thief. You know, opportunity makes the thief. Leave me alone with your booze if I'm at your party, and I'll find your grocery bags and stuff some in there, and I'm gone. Your money or your wallet's out? Well, you left it out. You must not care if I take what's in there. I mean, you know, but he didn't even do stuff like that, you know. And he was murdered. He was shot to death. And I definitely went into a really dark place. I had a good job at this time, and like I said, I had a job in my field, and you know, I had always told myself I wasn't gonna drink or anything before work, you know, and I kept that promise. I did. I went to work hungover plenty of times, but I never did it at work, you know. And I was always there on time, and I always did my job, you know, always. Even if I was a you-know-what because I was hungover, I think everybody hated me at the end of the day. I did what I had to do, and I left, and I, you know, did well. And, but after he was killed, I all of those nevers, you know, went away. Like, I had to start doing things so I could make it to work, so I could show up and be there and do whatever kind of job it was I was capable of doing at that point. And I went into a really, 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 really dark place. I wasn't of any service to the family, definitely. I didn't, like, reach out to his parents outside of the service. I didn't, I stayed in touch with Amy and Marie a lot because it was really hard for them too. And, Amy was his best friend, you know, they were really close, and it was really hard for her. And my using and my drinking got totally out of control. I honestly, and I'm not exaggerating, from like, you know, around March of 95 up until I came in these rooms in January of 97, I really don't remember a whole lot. And that's really true. I stayed as under the influence of something as long and as, you know, as much as often as I could, because I could not handle it. I could not handle the fact that he was gone. I couldn't deal with it. So anyway, I ended up talking a lot to, of course, Amy on the phone. And for another reason that isn't related to recovery, I ended up going to a support group in order to help me with something. I don't know how to say this. It's for the sake of anonymity, I can't say a whole lot about it. But put it this way, I had a friend who had an illness, and I went to this support group because I was devastated by the fact that my friend had this illness, you know. That was really difficult for me, and it was recommended to me by the friend who had the illness. They told me that there was such a thing. So I went there, and when I was in the support group, I met this girl that was the lead singer of my favorite band in Atlanta called Pagan Holiday. You can imagine what their music was like. And I love them, and I love to drink a lot and listen to them. I love to go see them live some every chance I got, and I loved her. Her name was Stelazine. Stelazine is an antipsychotic drug that she was given once when she was thrown into a psych ward, and she named herself after it. She was fabulous. She had bleach blonde hair, too much eye makeup, leather and chains, and she was this big, you know. And she was in the support group, and of course I was starstruck. You know, I'm like, oh my God, I love Pagan Holiday, you know. And I started talking to her, and come to find out, she was in recovery, and she had been in recovery for a while. And we just started talking about things, and she said, you know, if you ever feel like you're interested in recovery or attending a meeting, let me know. And I couldn't figure out why she would say that to me then, you know. Now I know. But so first there was that. And then, it wasn't too long after I started attending this group, you know, things weren't getting better. They were getting worse. Now, I remember one night I was laying in bed and I was just freaking out and I couldn't sleep. You know, I had insomnia all the time anyway. And I remember laying there and just, you know, saying, you know, I don't understand what the difference between me and Tom is. We did the same kind of stuff, you know. Why did he get killed, you know? I don't get it, you know. Why him and not me? What's the difference? And I swear, through the whole fiber of my being, I didn't hear it from outside myself. It was like I heard it from within myself. The answer was, there's no difference. And I was like, wow, there isn't any difference, you know. It was just, we just had different seats on the same Titanic ship, you know. So then I was talking on the phone a lot, like I said, to Amy and Marie. Marie had moved to Canada at that point, and Amy was here, and I was talking to her. And her dad had been in recovery for years. He's got over 30 years now. And so anyway, she told me she had started going to meetings, and I was like, wow. You're like the second person that's talked to me about recovery, you know. And then we're talking one night, and I called her up, you know, and I was drinking and smoking and crying. And she's like, you know, I'm going to just tell you what nobody else would say to you. I really think you need to go to a meeting. I'm like, why? Why would you say that, Amy? And then I went to my little support group, and I saw my buddy Stella again, and she said, And I said, my friend said I should go to a meeting, so I think I'm going to try it out. And she gave me this little, she wrote down on a slip of paper, because she didn't have a schedule, so she did it from memory, of this meeting that was close to my house. And that would eventually become my home group. And, of course, I didn't know that at the time, because I was purposely half an hour late. Because I figured, and this meeting was an hour and a half long. And I figured, you know, but and I realized later, it'll make sense as to why it was an hour and a half, but I'm like, okay, if it's an hour and a half, I get there an hour and a half late, I only have to stay for an hour, you know. So this meeting was called the Red Road Meeting, and it was a meeting based on Native American principles. They smudge with sage at the beginning, and there's this Indian Native American flute music playing, and you share on the third and 11th step. Perfect place for a new person in the rooms, right? And So anyway, so I went to this meeting, and it was by candlelight, and it was dark, and I was grateful as heck for that, man, because I was like, oh, good. And I went and I found, like, the furthest corner of the room to sneak and hug, you know, to sit down. And I even think I sat on the floor because I saw some other people doing it, and I think I could have found a chair, but I wanted to be as hidden as I could be, right? And for a long time, I went to that meeting, and I didn't talk to anybody. And I didn't say anything to anybody before or after. I just went in, I sat there, and then I left as soon as it was over. And I really liked it, though. I liked that meeting. And I had never heard the stuff I heard in that room before. And I had never had the feeling I had when I was in there. And the first time I went in there, it's the last time. Like, I haven't had a drink or a drug since. And so anyway, so I did that for a long time. And finally, trying to get out of there one night, and this guy that would become my really good friend, he was 6'2" and sounded like he smoked 5 packs of cigarettes a day, because he did. His name was Don. He scared the crud out of me. He said, hey, we're all going for coffee. Why don't you come over with us? I notice you leave out of here really fast every time. And I was like, okay, because I was scared to death of him. And I went, and I ended up making some really good friends. And I actually met the woman that would become my first sponsor that night. I didn't know that at the time either. So we hung out, you know, and then I started to do that. And this meeting, it met 3 days a week, and I started going to all 3 nights of that meeting. And then I met some people. This one night, my friend Stella came to that meeting. It was a Saturday, and she said, what are you doing for the rest of the night? I was like, I don't have any plans. And she said, oh, well, come with me. Leave your car here. And it's Atlanta, so you can go to meetings, like, pretty, you know, late into the evening if you want. We stayed in meetings until I think I got done at, like, by the last meeting, I think we got out of it, like, 1 or 1:30 in the night, you know, in the morning or something. I was so tired when I got home. And I did that every Saturday night with her for a really long time. And I found out later that that's what she did. That's one way she stayed sober, was she took the new person and she dragged him to as many meetings as she could drag him to. It made him really tired so they wouldn't drink. And like I said, I met, and the funny thing is how I got my first sponsor was I was feeling like I wanted to crawl out of my skin. You know, I was feeling really squirrely and really crazy. And so I went to 3 meetings in a row one day, and all 3 meetings were on sponsorship. Every single meeting I went to that day. And in the last meeting I went to that evening, and I didn't share in any of these meetings, okay? I didn't say a word. This is still at the point where I'm scared to share and stuff. And this one girl said, somebody was talking about how he didn't know about getting a sponsor. And she said, as far as waiting for the perfect sponsor is concerned, I never waited for the perfect drug dealer. So, and I was like, okay, so I get it. So the next time I saw this lady that I thought would be a good sponsor for me, I asked her to sponsor me, and she said yes, and she worked the steps with me, and she did a really good job taking me through the steps. She really did a good job, and she was a patient, patient woman. She said, call me every day. And I said, why would I call you every day? She said, call me every day. I said, okay, what if you don't answer? She said, leave a voicemail. I said, okay, will you call me back? She said, not always. I was thinking, who do you think you are? And she said, and follow directions. It'll help you a lot if you do what I tell you to do, if you do what I say. She said, I'm not saying that to be rude. It's just a fact. It'll help you a lot. I said, okay. And she said, make your bed every day. I was like, you're not even going to see my bedroom. I said, what does that have to do with anything? She said, make your bed every day. And she said, get a couple phone numbers every meeting you go to and call some of these people. I said, okay. So one day, and we started working the steps together, she had me read the first, you know, pages in the big book, and she said, I need you to read the first 165 pages of the big book, and then our real work together can begin. And I was like, what the heck is she talking about? And I started reading this book, and I started feeling like I identified with what was in it, you know. And anyway, what I forgot to share about was at this point, even though I've got the sponsor and I'm reading this book, I'm still kind of ping-ponging a little bit back and forth in my brain if I really belong in AA, because I didn't lose a job. Well, at least not that I'm aware of. I never got a DUI. I never went to jail. It's never, you know, any of these things. And one night I was in a meeting, and I heard this guy share that I didn't think I had anything in common with, because he looked like a fairly well-put-together individual. You know, he was dressed, like, kind of decent. He was, at that point, he was probably in his late 50s. And, you know, I wasn't sharing in that meeting, you know, still. It wasn't about me at all. I was just there. And he was sharing about how before he came in the rooms, he never felt like he belonged anywhere. He always felt like he was on the outside looking in. That was the first time anybody had ever said that. And then I knew I belonged, you know. I knew that I was in the right place. I'm like, wow. So that's the characteristic of, like, being an alcoholic. It's not just me because I had all this crazy stuff happen in my life, you know. So worked the steps with a sponsor. And, you know, my home group, I ended up, I forgot, when I was 7 months sober, I made the brilliant decision to marry my future ex-husband, my using buddy, because I knew that if I didn't, I would have to end that relationship. And I really did love him, and I really didn't want to end the relationship, because he was going this way, and I was going this way, so I decided it would be a good idea to marry him. And that's what I did, and I didn't tell my sponsor I was going to do it. I didn't tell any of my recovery friends I was going to do it. I didn't even tell Amy or Marie I was going to do it. I just did it. And that ended up being really interesting. And as I said, he's now my ex-husband. For various reasons. We had some points in our marriage when he thought it would be a good idea to spend all of our money on cocaine. He also thought it would be a good idea to lie to me a lot. You know, that kind of thing. The kind of stuff that we do. So it didn't work out. But, so I ended up getting a second sponsor after the first one, lived in Savannah for a year, and that didn't work too well. So we moved back to Atlanta, and I got a new sponsor because some things changed for the first sponsor, and that was okay. She's still a great person, but I needed to do something different. And I decided that a district attorney for the city of Atlanta would be a good choice, and she didn't really put up with any of my stuff. Like, if I had ever said half the stuff to her I said to the first sponsor, she hung up on me all the time. All the time. I'd call her up like, she'd be like, okay, call me back later. She just didn't care. She didn't care. She wasn't going to have it, you know. I would tell her, well, I can't go to a meeting because I'm working too much. She'd be like, well, then get a different job. You know, she was like, so what? You know, oh, well, I can't get a ride. Well, walk. You know, that was her whole approach to it. She was like, whatever, you know. And she had me do it. She had me do, you know, work the steps all the time. But like the 4 through, you know, 9, we had to do that once a year together. At minimum, you know, minimum. There was one time she made me do 2 4-step inventories in a year, you know. That's how she rolled. And as a result, my head was screwed on pretty straight when she was my sponsor. As I mentioned, during that time, my then husband decided he was going to spend all of our money on drugs. And I ended up at the age of 32 with nowhere to go. Couldn't pay the rent. Couldn't do anything, and decided it would be a good idea to separate myself from him, because there came a point when, you know, I had to make a choice. I think at some point, maybe not for everybody, but at least for me, you know, I was at that crossroads, and I had to either choose my recovery or choose this person, and I chose my recovery, because I can't ever get this back. Because really, for me, I know that I'm pretty lazy, and I know that I'm not going to go to all this trouble again. I don't think I will. I really think that this is it, you know, and I really don't want to mess it up. I really don't want to lose it. So I left him and moved back here, and I moved in with my mom and my stepfather. And just to give you a clue about the way I used to feel about my stepfather, he was on every single inventory that I did up until 2 years ago. Yeah, And I had to move in with him and see him every day. And because I had a program, I couldn't say any of the stuff to him or treat that I wanted to or treat him the way I used to treat him. But he didn't change at all. So that wasn't easy. And so anyway, you know, moved to Rutgersville. That's where my mom lives. And right down the road from where I live, there was a meeting. What is now my home group met on Cedar Grove and Cedar Grove Church of the Brethren. And I didn't go to that meeting for the first 2 months that I moved back here, even though my butt was falling off. I didn't have a sponsor here. And I wasn't allowed to use my stepfather's phone. Okay. Yeah, it's a whole other story. Like I said, inventory every year, except for the past couple of years. Anyway, so I really needed to go to meetings. And I didn't go to that meeting because I was like, you know, those people aren't going to understand me because I got sober in Atlanta. And they're a bunch of, like, rednecks. And, you know, it's just not going to work. So for a long time, I went to meetings in Charlottesville. And I would stay really late after I got off work and go to this one meeting, you know, sometimes, like, on Fridays and then some other meetings. And I did that even though this meeting was 7 minutes from my house. And, one Friday night, I was exhausted. I was so tired, I could barely see straight because I was really depressed when I moved back here. I did not want to come back to Virginia. I had a good life in Atlanta. I had a whole, like, life in recovery. There was a lot to do, and I was really happy there. I felt like I was forced to come back here, and I resented it every day. I was miserable. I cried every day, at least once, sometimes twice a day for the first 2 months I was back here. And so that was taking a lot out of me and making me exhausted. And I didn't want to go to that meeting. But one night I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go to that meeting. And I'll just go in there and I'll just sit down. And then I'll just leave. I'll do what I used to do. So I went in there and, like, there's some really good recovery in there, you know. And I met my first AA friend that I made here in Virginia. This woman, this lovely woman named Pat Stalker, who has since passed away. She came up to me, you know, she was like this fabulous lady, and she shook my hand, and she asked me all about myself, and before I knew it, I had a lunch date with her for like a day or two later. Went over to her house for lunch, and then I met two other women that are still my friends, you know. And then they invited me to their house, and then I met a couple more of them, and they're still my friends, you know. And all of a sudden, I was like, why did I think I didn't want to go to that meeting? What's so different about me? You know, blah, 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 blah. And shortly after that, it became my home group, you know, and it still is. You know, eventually I did make it, and my then husband came back here, and he moved into my mom's with me eventually, and we went to marriage counseling, which was all his idea. He lied the whole time we were in marriage counseling, but I didn't know that at the time. I thought he was sincere. That was the thing about him. He was really good at pretending to be sincere, and I was really good at believing him. And so that's what I did, and, you know, we moved out. We got our own place. We started a business together, and things were going really well. Really well. And we got to a point where we were, you know, we had rented a house in Orange, and, you know, we were actually looking to adopt a child, you know, because I tried to get pregnant for a long time, and I couldn't, so we were going to adopt a child. And I thought my life was complete. And then he started doing these plays, and he decided that he wanted to party with a bunch of 20-year-olds more than he wanted to be married to me and have our little, like, nice, normal adult life together. And I decided I wasn't going to go through everything I'd been through a second time, you know. So I left him. And that's what I did. And one of those friends that I made, that I met at Pat Stalker's house for lunch that day, let me stay at her house when I left him. She took me in and let me stay there rent-free for an entire summer until I had enough money to get an apartment, you know. And I had a sponsor then. She was my sponsor. I forgot to mention her for a long time, for about 10 years, I guess, for a long time. And her working with me really worked for me for a long time, and then it really stopped working for me. but I was so scared to change that I kept her for a long time when I knew I should make a change. There's nothing wrong with her. There's nothing wrong with the way she works with her sponsees. She's wonderful. I just saw her the other day, as a matter of fact, and we talked each other's ears off. We have a great relationship. It just was time for me to move on. And I prayed on that for a long time. I ignored it. And so I've left my husband. I've got my own apartment. I'm doing recovery, and I'm staying sober, and I'm hanging out with my friends a lot. And during this time, I met my now boyfriend and actually ended up having the first healthy relationship I've ever had my entire life. Ever. I mean, even in grade school, I think my relationships were sketchy. You know? I really do. I ended up changing sponsors. And what happened for me was I went into a depression because I ended up having to leave the apartment where I was and move back into my mom's, you know. I'm like in my 40s at this point. And I didn't get any of the stuff that I wanted. And I was feeling real sorry for myself. And I knew I needed to make a change. So I changed sponsors. And the most amazing part of that for me is that the way that she works with me, is when I go to a meeting, I don't share about all my stuff. Like, I don't throw up all over you, you know? I'm there to contribute to the meeting. And for me, nobody had ever said that to me before. I was like, oh, my God, you know, that's amazing, really? And when I'm having a bad day or I've got some stuff going on, her and I talk about it and we work it out together. And then I can take the solution to the meeting. But if I call somebody else on that day to talk to them, I'm calling them to see how they are. And I was like, oh, my God, really? I can't believe it. I know that seems like I should have figured that out or heard that somewhere, but I'm not kidding. I swear on my life, I never heard that before. Nobody ever said that to me. And it has been life-changing because of the core of my disease is self-pity and self-centeredness. And I threw up on meetings for years. I'm embarrassed now to think about some of the stuff I went in with, you know. And people probably left crying, you know. They didn't go in there. They weren't uplifted by the time I was done. I feel bad now about sometimes the people that I called, you know. I can't believe they still answer my calls. You know, they were probably having a good day until they heard from me. Well, it's so awful, you know. I mean, that is amazing to me, and it has changed my life, and it has really given me the best recovery that I've ever had. As a result of recovery today, I get to go back to school. I still have a business. I split my clients with my ex-husband. I took half of them, and, you know, I'm fairly successful. I'm not in the, you know, in the penthouse on Park Avenue, but I pay my bills, and I really like having my own business, you know. And when I started it 3 years ago when we separated, I had 6 clients, you know. And I only had, I think, 1 client that was every week at that point. So that's pretty amazing for me. And that's definitely a gift of recovery because, you've heard about my job history, you know. And I'm going back to school and I'm doing, you know, the business, and I'm doing school, and that's definitely a gift of recovery because, you know, I failed the 8th grade, you know, and here I am. I'm going back to college to get another degree so I can make more money and, you know, hopefully do something that's a little more creative than what I do now because I'm actually a really creative person, believe it or not. Another gift of recovery for me today is that I don't feel like I want to throw up all over meetings anymore. That's the most amazing thing. It's like all that misery and suffering just isn't there anymore. It's just not. I mean, I definitely have stuff to deal with, like anybody. You know, we've all got stuff, and sometimes one little thing happens, and my brain automatically thinks it's always going to be awful, and that means everything else is going to be awful forever, you know, because I'm an alcoholic. That's how I think. But that's not true today, and it always passes, you know. And, you know, the other gift, I guess, is that people actually want to hear what I have to say today, and that's pretty amazing, because that definitely wasn't always the case. I think that I have probably taken up just about enough time. But one more thing I would like to say is I would like to thank Sam for asking me to speak tonight, and to thank all of you for having me, because I've been a regular attendee at this meeting for quite some time, and I've heard some great speakers here, and I feel really honored to be among them. So thank you so much.